History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by the U.S. Army, proudly honoring the men and women from every branch of our armed forces whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories out there that we really need to hear. We don't want them to go untold, and we want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we take that journey, we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Today, I'm in Oceanside, California with 99-year-old George Coburn. He'll turn 100 this coming October, but we're going to talk about where he was on that day of infamy many years ago. And we'll start even before that. George, you're born in Minnesota, but grew up here in the San Diego area. What was it like here in the 1930s? And you're one of seven children in your family. What was that childhood like?
San Diego was a small town. Commercial fishing was the biggest industry, and the aircraft industry, which became really a major thing later, was just getting started when I was a youngster. They built a lot of airplanes here, both military and commercial planes.
And what kinds of things were you up to as a boy? What were the things that kept you busy? Because I know you're still busy at 99. You're doing lapidary work with your great-grandson. So you must have been a pretty busy boy back then.
I was a busy boy, yeah, but I wasn't doing anything productive. I loved to get out in the back country, we had a lot of wide open space back then, and there's an area now called Padre Trails Park, and I used to wander around that area before it became a park, and I'd camp there, and we had our campfires, and which are now illegal. Needless to say, things have changed.
And how'd you get along with all your siblings? Since you were one of the younger ones, did they pick on you at all?
No, I didn't have any problem. Actually, the first three were half-brothers. My mother had an early marriage, and she had three children by that marriage. When the third child was born, her husband disappeared, and she married Coburn after she came out here. They were both bakers, and surprising thing, Mom came from Australia. Her folks immigrated from Denmark to Australia for free land, and also because their home in Denmark was right on the German border, and there was a lot of controversy going on about who owned this land, who did it belong to, and they were happy to go out to the Great Outback, as it was called, and they were in Queensland. I believe the town that they were near was called Darling Downs. The reason they came to America was they had a drought, California style. It went on for years and years, and the productivity of the land dropped so low that they couldn't keep animals anymore, and they couldn't sustain themselves. So they left. And Grandpa heard that Minnesota was a land of 10,000 lakes, and that's why I was born in Minnesota. Because he said, that's the place for me. But we wound up in San Diego because Mom was a victim of the Spanish flu, which was epidemic at the time. Her doctor told her, you got to get out of Minnesota or you won't survive. So Dad sent her out here. Let me go back a couple of years. Dad was the ship's baker on the ship that Mom came to America on. They didn't meet at that time, but Mom also became a baker, and they met through their vocation in Minnesota. Unlikely sequence of events, but...
Yeah, what are the odds of that? And when did they figure that out, that he had been the baker on the ship she came over on?
Well, because they talked about her immigrating, so he probably asked what ship. Dad was a character. He was apprenticed to a baker in Kentucky, where he was born, and he was mistreated pretty badly, apparently, and he ran away, 12 years old, and he made his way. I don't know very much of his early life, but as a young man, he went to Alaska for the gold rush, and damn near died of starvation up there. He didn't find any appreciable amount of gold. I don't know how he wound up in Minnesota and ultimately met my mother, and they had a pretty good life together, though, although he died fairly young. I was about 10 years old when he passed away.
Well, I don't want to put words in your mouth or thoughts in your head, but just listening to that, I'm thinking it was a minor miracle that you were ever born. I mean, for your mom to come from Australia, end up in Minnesota, meet the guy who was the baker on the ship who she came over on, but he ran away from Kentucky, gone to Alaska looking for gold, and somehow they meet in Minnesota, or else you're not here right now.
Well, I got here. I'm not questioning it. I have to accept what comes.
Well, and almost a century later, here we are. Well, and you mentioned that, your father dying when you're 10 years old.
Yeah.
That can't be easy for a 10-year-old to process, and it couldn't have been easy on your family, especially entering into the Great Depression right then.
Yeah, the Great Depression was a real factor. Happily, the oldest of my half-siblings, he worked for the County of San Diego, and he was a surveyor. He maintained the family. To me, he was a father figure. He was about 10 years older than me, and if we wanted to do something that required special permission, we have to ask Ed.
Well, and Ed, like you, would go on to serve in World War II, but what about those Depression years? Because most people alive today, I mean, we see hard times, and we see things around the world that are devastating, but I don't know if we can really grasp what it must have been like for you guys and how tough the times were. Are there some examples that you recall that illustrate kind of the gravity of those years?
Well, I worked at whatever I could earn a nickel and a dime at. I sold magazines, and I had a paper route, and so I always had a nickel and a dime to rub together. Getting a real job was difficult. After I was out of high school, somebody told my mom about a job that she knew was coming up, and it was a do-everything boy on a used car lot, and paid 25 cents an hour. And I went down and I got that job. I was still working there when I went into the Navy. I figured the Navy was a lot more solid position than that boy on the car lot.
And you joined the Navy in 1938, 3 years before America's drawn into World War II. Why'd you do that? What was it about the Navy that made you decide to sign up?
Well, San Diego was primarily a Navy town, and the way it happened, I didn't have any idea about joining the Navy. I hadn't given it a thought, but one day my good friend Perry, who I went camping and hunting with, came by and he says, "Hey, George, I'm going down to join the Navy. Why don't you come with me?" And I said, "Are you crazy, Perry?" And he talked to me, and finally I went and asked the boss if I could have a couple hours off. And my intent at that time was I would just go down with Perry and keep him company while he sacrificed his life for the Navy. But as it worked out, I got in the Navy and Perry didn't. Perry had a police record, and it was kind of strange the way it happened. But Perry liked horses, and he was down in Mission Valley near Lakeside, and he found a horse wandering around without any attention. And so he jumped on the horse and was riding it. And the people looking for the horse were a little bit unhappy with Perry because they thought that he had stolen the horse. And he got charged with that. The sad part of it, from Perry's point of view, was the horse belonged to the deputy sheriff out there.
So you're telling me you got tricked into joining the Navy by a horse thief. Is that your story?
That's my story, yeah.
And I'm just picturing a horse running around Mission Valley now and all that maze of freeways. That would be a different story.
I had time down there now. I spent a lot of time down in Mission Valley. That was my playground. They had borrow pits down there where they dredged sand out of the riverbed and used it to make concrete and build the city. Mm-hmm. And those borrow pits made great swimming holes, see? We did a lot of skinny dipping down there in Mission Valley.
Well, and maybe in some of those same spots, that's where the Chargers ended up playing for years and the Padres for years until they built their new stadium further south. I bet you couldn't imagine anything like that. I mean, you didn't even have baseball on the West Coast then in the major leagues.
No. Baseball was never very important to me, still isn't for that matter. But I was just thinking, there may be a hotel built on one of our old swimming holes.
Well, so you end up in the Navy. What were you expecting? What did you think was going to happen?
In the Navy? I looked at the Navy as a job, and I kind of enjoyed the Navy. The routine didn't bother me at all, and I didn't have any real plans as far as my Navy career was concerned. Because I had good grades in mathematics, primarily, I was put into the fire control division, and that became my career focus in the Navy. And I became a chief fire controlman in a matter of about 3 years, which was pretty unusual, and after a year as chief, they promoted me to an officer rank. So one day the gunnery officer called me up to his room, and he says, "Coburn, we want to promote you." He says, "What do you want to be? You want to be an ensign or a warrant officer?" And I said, "I want to be a warrant officer, because to me, the warrant officer was the top of a pyramid, and the ensign was on the very bottom." So about a month later, my commission came back, and I was an ensign.
Well, I know we're going to talk about December 7th, 1941, and you were in a place that we have very few people remaining today that were there to experience it. But what about the time before that? You're on the USS Oklahoma, this battleship, before the attack on Pearl Harbor. Can you help us understand what that everyday Navy life out on the islands was like?
It was kind of boring. As a matter of fact, Linda has cited one of my letters home in which I said, "Yesterday was boring and today is just like yesterday, and tomorrow will be just like today." Then I said, "Something's bound to happen soon." And this was just about 3 weeks before Pearl Harbor. And something did happen. By the time Pearl Harbor came about, I had become the head fire controlman on the anti-aircraft battery. And that morning, on December 7th, I was in the plotting room cutting in circuits to the anti-aircraft directors. I was going to go up. It was working day for me. I was going to go up and run tests on the directors to be sure they were performing as they should, because we had a big inspection coming up the next 3 days, and I didn't want to get special citation.
So you're thinking, I got to make sure all these anti-aircraft guns are working so we don't fail inspection. And you had no idea that there was an enemy that was bearing down on you, was going to show up that morning. Was there ever any talk of we could be at war?
Yeah, we talked about the possibility of a war with Japan. And because, you know, Japan was in the news quite a bit. They were pretty aggressive in their dealings with their neighbors, and people in the United States thought that was improper, and probably was. But anyway, that's about as deep as the conversation got on it. I mean, we never really discussed it in depth and what if, and nobody had any idea. Even the top brass in the Navy didn't think that torpedoes could be used in Pearl Harbor. They said it's too shallow. The Japanese developed a shallow running torpedo, and they also made some kind of special adapter to where the torpedo wouldn't dive and hit the bottom when it was launched off an aircraft.
And he would feel the impact of the first torpedo to strike the battleship USS Oklahoma on December 7th, 1941. We'll talk about that when we come back. You heard George Coburn mention Linda, and that's Dr. Linda Dudick, a retired history professor who's working with him on a book about his experiences in the Navy in World War II, not only escaping the sunken USS Oklahoma on December 7th, but also his time the rest of the war on the decorated heavy cruiser USS Louisville. At hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, you can find a short video of George describing how he made it off his capsized battleship. And he'll walk us through it step by improbable step when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by the U.S. Army, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy. The United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan.
President Franklin D. Roosevelt addressing the nation December 8, 1941. You've heard it before, and you've heard quite a few Pearl Harbor survivors here on Hometown Heroes. Each one adds a little different perspective on a disastrous and devastating day that cost the lives of more than 2,400 Americans, but also triggered a response throughout the U.S. that would lead to the defeat of not just Imperial Japan, but the Nazi regime in Germany as well. And it can be easy to take this for granted, but if 1940s America and its allies had not come together to repel those tyrannical threats, we would be living in a very different world 75 years later. The century mark is something George Coburn is going to celebrate in October, and today we have the privilege of listening to an amazingly sharp 99-year-old recall what he experienced at Pearl Harbor that day. Born in Minnesota, raised in San Diego, he enlisted in the Navy in 1938, and on December 7, 1941, he was on the third deck of the USS Oklahoma, just below the waterline when that battleship was struck amidships by a Japanese torpedo.
That morning, while I was in the plotting room, I heard the public address system was keyed open, and I could hear a hiss and a little background noise, and then this voice came up and said, "All hands, man your battle stations." And then he came back and said, "Real planes, real bombs, no shit." And it was an officer who said that, and later he explained that he knew that enlisted men used "no shit" as an exclamation and to emphasize a point. And he wanted to emphasize the real planes, real bombs. But it worked backward, because I heard that and I thought, geez, that doesn't belong on a public address system. This must be a bogus announcement total. And I went over to the next compartment. There was an electrician there, and I asked him what he thought about it. And he says, some drunk probably got back from Liberty and found a access to the PA system, decided he'd have a little fun. And then a more authoritative voice came up on the PA system and made the standard call to battle stations and also set off the general alarm. And so I started for my battle station. I made a detour to go to the shop and get a shirt out of my locker, because you didn't go topside without a shirt in those days. And my battle station was in an anti-aircraft director, and so I had a lot of climbing to do to get up there. And the Navy had a rule for everything, and traffic control was you move forward and up on the starboard side and aft and down on the port side. But they had another rule, and that was in the event of an air raid, all unengaged personnel go below the second deck, which was an armored deck. So I got to the up ladder, and they were sending people down, and I couldn't get up. I never got to my battle station. And when the last man cleared the hatch, they slammed it down and dogged it down tight from up above. And so there were probably, I don't know, about 20 men in this little area where the ladder, they were all people who had topside battle stations, and of course nobody got there. The first torpedo hit, and the deck jumped, and it was a little bit more of a shock than when the main battery went off, but we weren't unaccustomed to explosions, because we had gunnery practice fairly often. And anyway, the lights went out, and more torpedoes hit the ship. I've heard all kinds of numbers on how many there were, and I didn't try to count them, so I can't argue with them.
Is that the first time that it was really real to you, though, when you felt the impact of that first torpedo? Is that when you first knew that this was real and this was war?
Yeah, I would guess that was probably the beginning of realization that we got a problem here. Mm-hmm. One of the things that happened was a source of oil got ruptured, and we got sprayed with fuel oil, and the deck got covered with fuel oil. And because of that, and the ship was beginning to list, people couldn't stand up. And it wound up that a pool of oil formed against the low side bulkhead, and men were slipping into that pool and just wallowing around in oil down there. I thought many times, if they just thought about it, they have figured out how to get the heck out of there, but they didn't. Far as I know, they probably perished right there.
Because they drowned in the pool of oil?
Well, because they couldn't get out of the ship, because they were stuck in this pool. And
again, this is in the dark as well. The lights are out. Can you see anything?
I could see a little, because somebody showed up with a flashlight, and that was a big help. that helped the guys that were up on the ladder and trying to get the hatch open. It helped them a lot because they were using their fists and or anything they could find to try to hammer the dogs from their tight position. And well, they finally got it open, and everybody rushed for the ladder, and the darn thing broke. I don't know just what happened, but either some fitting came loose, or the pin that secured the top of the ladder sheared, because had a lot of men on the ladder, and the deck was over maybe 45 degrees by then, and oil on the deck didn't help the ladder stay in position either, so it just twisted. And somebody had the good sense to yell, "Everybody get the hell off the ladder or nobody will get out of here, it'll break." And so the people complied with that, and then we went up one by one, and I don't know whether everybody got out or not, but we got up to the second deck and then on up to the main deck, and there was probably 10 of us together at that time. And I looked back, the normal exit from the ship would be out onto the quarter deck, and that was about maybe 100 feet away. There was a big group of men back there. It didn't appear to be moving. And besides, there was all kinds of gear and lockers and bunks and everything that was loose or jarred loose by the explosions had slid down against the bulkhead, and we would have had to crawl or make our way over that stuff in order to get back to the weather deck. I saw an open porthole. Shouldn't have been open. We were at general quarters. If it had been closed, I probably wouldn't even thought of trying to get out of porthole. But I decided that's for me. I went, crawled up across whatever was available to get a handhold on, and a few fellas followed me. Some of them went and started going back to the weather deck. And anyway, six of us got out of that porthole. And at the time, the side of the ship was easy to stand on because ship had rolled over far enough to where it wasn't level yet, but it was close to it. And some of the things I should have mentioned. When we were down in the fourth deck and torpedoes were hitting, and we had the light from a flashlight, but no more. Some of the guys were yelling, and some were cursing, and some were praying. And I'll always remember one voice that called for Mama to come and help. He called repeatedly, "Mama, come and help me." And he was in the pool of oil. And,
well, what about you? I mean, you're describing this. I know you're a 22-year-old young man at the time. You didn't know this was going to happen. This came completely out of the blue. I mean, it sounds absolutely terrifying. Did you feel that fear? Was there panic? How did you handle it?
I didn't feel any fear or panic, but I think I was in shock. It isn't hard to remember, because I'll remember this the most hours forever. I don't know. It's.
And I know there are a lot of other details here, but if you hadn't seen that open porthole, what do you think would have happened to you?
I probably would have died in the ship. Linda has told me repeatedly, says, "You're both lucky and smart." She said, you made a lot of good decisions to get out of the ship, and you also were lucky to find to have the avenues available to get out. And I have to agree that those two things were big factors.
Well, and reading some of what you two have been working on, I noted the story about the chaplain and that porthole.
Oh, yeah. Well, I wasn't there. A different porthole. We had a lot of portholes.
Yeah.
And anyway, the chaplain, he wasn't a heavy man. His bony structure was such that he had wide hips, and he wouldn't fit through the porthole. I tried to drag him through, and it just wouldn't work. And he stood back and helped push other fellas through. And undoubtedly, by then, he knew that his life was going to end shortly. And but it took courage to behave the way he did and to do something that helped somebody. He couldn't help himself, but he could help somebody else, and he did it.
Is he someone you'd been familiar with on the ship, or no?
Well, I knew the chaplain because his office was right next to the fire control sleeping compartment, and so I would see him frequently, and I certainly knew who he was and what his job was and et cetera. But I was never a church-going guy, so I didn't really know the chaplain.
Well, here's a little that we do know about that chaplain, and I have this linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com. His name was Aloysius Schmidt. He was a 32-year-old Catholic priest from Iowa, and he had just celebrated Mass aboard the Oklahoma when that first torpedo struck. Survivors' accounts say that Father Schmidt helped as many as 12 sailors through that porthole that he himself could not squeeze through. In 1942, he was posthumously awarded the Non-Combat Navy and Marine Corps Medal, but that award has since been upgraded. In 2016, the Defense POW MIA Accounting Agency was able to identify his remains and finally return him home to Iowa. The publicity around that story produced newfound interest in Father Schmidt's heroism on December 7th. And in 2017, in Dubuque, Iowa, at his alma mater, Loras College, Schmidt's family was presented by the Navy's Chief of Chaplains with the Silver Star. The citation reading, "With unselfish disregard for his own plight, he assisted his shipmates through the aperture. When they in turn were in the process of rescuing him, his body became tightly wedged in the narrow opening. Realizing that other men had come into the compartment seeking a way out," the citation continues about Father Al, as he was known, "he insisted he be pushed back into the ship so that others might escape. Calmly urging them on with his blessing, he remained behind while his shipmates crawled out to safety. In so doing, he gallantly gave up his life for his country." Aloysius Schmidt, one of the more than 2,400 Americans who lost their lives on Oahu on that day of infamy. But we still need to hear the rest of one survivor's story. More with 99-year-old George Coburn when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com. And tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by the U.S. Army. Find your place on the Army team at goarmy.com/warriors.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and an eye-opening conversation with 99-year-old George Coburn of Oceanside, California, one of the last remaining survivors from the battleship USS Oklahoma at Pearl Harbor. We've heard how he was in the plotting room down below when the alarm sounded. He felt the impact of the first of at least 9 torpedoes that struck the ship that Sunday morning, and soon he was trapped in a dark, oily, chaotic mess. We've heard him explain how he eventually was able to climb up, ultimately to find a porthole and get out onto what was really the side of the ship, now capsized in a once tranquil harbor turned into a horrific scene. And what was that scene from your vantage point, George? What did you see when you finally got out of that porthole?
I saw a lot of smoke and fire, and I saw airplanes buzzing around, and I heard the zing of ricocheting bullets because they kept making passes down the battleship row and strafing. I slid down the side of the bottom of the ship, actually, and into the water and kicked off my shoes in order to swim better. And the ship was tied up to the Maryland, and as it turned over, the space between the two ships widened and was maybe 60, 75 feet wide by the time I got in the water. And the ropes that had tied two ships together parted as Oklahoma rolled over, and some of them were still hanging into the water, and each of those had a dozen men trying to climb up, and nobody could make any progress because it just too many, and they were like a bunch of bananas. Me and other fellows yelled at people who looked over the side of the Maryland and throw down some more ropes so we can come aboard. And eventually somebody did, and I got aboard the Maryland and was put to work immediately handling ammunition to a 3-inch 50 anti-aircraft gun, which I might say was one of the most useless weapons the Navy had. The probability of hitting an airplane with that gun was somewhat below zero.
It's like trying to hit a butterfly with a bazooka or something?
Yeah.
Well, and you mentioned because your ship has rolled over so far, you're actually sliding down the bottom of the ship into the water. And was that water on fire? Was it oily? What were you dealing with there?
Well, it was foul because we didn't have a tank aboard ship to store sewage until we were far at sea. It went right into the bay. So Pearl Harbor was probably some of the most polluted water in the world.
And are there still bullets flying while you're in the water trying to get a rope?
Well, the Arizona blew up while I was in the water. That was a magnificent explosion. The ball of fire rolled up and didn't dissipate right away. It just kept rising. And Arizona released a lot of fuel oil, and it was on the surface of the water, and the wind was blowing it toward us. It was on fire. That didn't worry me because I was a good swimmer, and I figured I can swim faster than that's coming. But anyway, I did get go aboard to Maryland, and was kind of disheartening, you know. Had just lost my home and probably some good friends, all of my personal belongings. The only thing I had was what I happened to have in my pocket when I left the ship. That happened to be a little screwdriver about 3 inches long. So wasn't much utility in that.
You know, here you've been through all this, but you get aboard the Maryland, and there's still a battle going on. So they throw you right into work passing the ammunition.
The Maryland got hit by a bomb while I was aboard. I understand the damage wasn't really bad, but it wouldn't take long, but they moved all of us from the Oklahoma over onto Ford Island and mustered us and began trying to find out who made it out and who didn't. And from there, they moved us on over to Westlock, which was an ammunition depot. and we went to work replenishing ammunition to make up for what had been expended during the raid. One of the ships that came in, it was a destroyer that had been on offshore patrol and had sunk a midget submarine. They came in for depth charges, and a bunch of angry sailors, because what I heard from them was that the ship had sent in to headquarters in Pearl Harbor that they had sunk a submarine in a restricted area. And I call it restricted area because they had this area outside out in the open ocean where a submarine was not allowed to proceed submerged unless they had a surface escort. So the destroyer, I think the name was Ward, the thing that they were incensed about was they sent the word in and they got a return message that said, verify the report they sent back to Pearl Harbor. Verify hell, we're sinking another one right now. So exactly how that exchange went, I don't know, but that's what I got from the crew.
And the implication is that people, well, ships like yours could have been on alert as opposed to caught off guard if that had been communicated correctly?
I don't know that it would have done a whole lot of good. Getting a ship underway and clearing a harbor, I don't think we had time to do it.
So there were 429 who died aboard the Oklahoma that day. Did it set in immediately for you that certain guys were lost, or was there an uncertainty for a while you're trying to figure out which ones of your friends made it and who didn't?
It took me a long time to figure that out because information, well, there was a lot of information running around and being repeated here, there, and everywhere, but you never knew whether it was bogus or whether it was real. And so as a result, nobody felt well informed.
Well, and I don't want to leave anything out from 77, almost 78 years ago now, but with all this time and finally seeing the list and finding out over time who didn't make it, are there some people that you knew well that you still reflect on every once in a while that were killed that day?
Yes. Yeah. There was later during the war, we had a beer bus once in a while on one of the South Pacific islands. We didn't have any of those grass-skirted girls, but anyway, I met a fellow who told me about one of the fire patrolmen that he saw before he got out of the ship. And I won't mention the guy's name because he may have family still wondering. But anyway, he saw this fellow, a red-headed kid. He was down at the low side of the ship and wallowing around in a flooded area and apparently confused to the degree where he couldn't make any real progress. I always wondered what happened to that guy. He wasn't a close friend. I didn't know him well, but he was in my division and an acquaintance. But then I looked in the book Battleship Oklahoma, and there's a list of the entire crew and who survived and who didn't, and after this kid's name was missing in action. He didn't make it.
Well, and there are quite a few whose remains were never identified, and just in the last couple of years, they've started to identify more of those and return them home.
Using DNA to identify them. They get family samples and are able to pretty well lock in the identity that way.
Well, and another thing that was fairly unique about the Oklahoma is because it capsized, there were still some pockets of air, and there were guys trapped inside for a day and a half. Were you guys aware at the time? Did you hear about the crews that were working to try to rescue them?
Yes. Yeah, we heard about them. Mm-hmm. In fact, I saw some of the activity. It had already started while I was still aboard the Maryland, and they really got on it promptly, and of course they were able to save what 30-some-odd men, and too bad they couldn't get more. But
well, and that's what I was curious about, because here, this is your ship, and this has been such a devastating situation. I mean, it devastated the whole country. But to have that rescue a day and a half later, was that a shot in the arm?
Somewhat, yeah. Although, by then, I was over in Westlock handling ammunition. I had no real firsthand news. You know, there were all kinds of stories running around. I mean, we were going to be invaded, and a lot of, well, let's say sailors have a good imagination. If they didn't have a story, they made one up.
Was there a moment for you where the magnitude of the whole situation sank in, where you could fathom how much had been destroyed and how devastating it was?
There actually was a moment like that. But it wasn't in proximity to the actual happening. It was decades later. In fact, it was fairly recent. I've thought about that morning many times, but this one time it seemed real again. And I thought, yeah, there's something missing here. And later I wrote that the thing that was missing might be the emotional devastation that we suffered. I wrote, we lost our home, probably some good friends, all of our personal belongings, and our magnificent fleet was rapidly being turned into junk. I really felt the impact of that morning more strongly at that time than I did while I was experiencing it.
Well, and you know, I threw out that number, 429, and the only ship that lost more that morning was the Arizona, of course. But what about your family back here in San Diego? I'm sure they're hearing it on the radio that Pearl Harbor has been attacked. They know that's where you are. What did they experience?
You know, the Salvation Army, some ladies came by when I was at Westlock, and they gave us postcards and already stamped and pencils. And so I wrote on the postcard and put it in the mail. And I was lucky enough to get home in January, and I walked in the door, and they thought I was a ghost. The postcard hadn't arrived, and it didn't arrive for several more weeks.
So your mother had presumed, because of the news reports, that you had died.
That's what they thought, yeah. They thought that I'd gone down with the ship like so many others did.
But then you walked in the door.
Yeah.
So what was the look on your mother's face?
Astonishment. And probably mixed with relief and et cetera, but I don't know. Primarily it was astonishment.
And you naturally had assumed that they'd received the postcard, right?
Yes, I had assumed that. And otherwise I might have tried to make some kind of pre-entry contact. But I just walked in the door like I'd been across the street talking to Charlie.
That must have caught you off guard to see your mother's reaction.
Well, yes, it did. It surprised me. By that time, I'd had enough recent surprises, though, that didn't have any problem with it.
A much better surprise than what he experienced on December 7th. George Coburn, 99 years old, of Oceanside, California, survivor of the USS Oklahoma at Pearl Harbor. And he would go on to serve for the duration of the war aboard the heavy cruiser USS Louisville. But by now, you've probably figured out that we're about out of time on this episode, so we'll wait till next time to explore what he did on the Louisville, a ship that earned 13 battle stars in the Pacific. So we'll look forward to those adventures with Mr. Coburn. And don't forget to visit hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page for photos and a short video relating to Mr. Coburn and his remarkable story. Thanks so much for spending this hour with us. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by the U.S. Army, building a new generation of leaders at goarmy.com/warriors.
If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.